WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you can't raise several million dollars, you probably won't win a seat in Congress. And once elected, a typical U.S. senator needs to raise $12,000 a week to have enough money to run for his or her next election. The corrupting influence of all that money has gotten two political foes, liberal consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative political strategist Paul Weyrich, to join together to advocate campaign financing reforms. They're carrying on a fight begun by Philip Stern, who had been railing for years against the influence of money in Congress before his death this past June. An updated edition of Stern's 1988 book, The Best Congress Money Can Buy, has just been published. Still, The Best Congress Money Can Buy details how political action committees and wealthy individual campaign contributors have been circumventing laws designed to control and limit the flow of money to members of Congress. Ralph Nader is seen as the father of the consumer movement in this country. He first took on the auto industry in the mid-60s with his book Unsafe at Any Speed. Paul Weyrich is one of the leading new right political strategists and helped to put together the Moral Majority and the Heritage Foundation. I asked Ralph Nader to explain the current rules that govern how much money a PAC can spend on a political campaign.
$5,000 for the primary and then $5,000 for the general election. So it's a $10,000 limit, and that's what the political action committees mean when they say they've packed out on a candidate. But, of course, individuals can give $1,000 in the primary, $1,000 for the general election. And that means that the PACs are increasingly at an advantage. The PACs are technically corporations. So corporations can give more than individuals. And since there are 4,500 political action committees, at least, registered with the Federal Election Commission, you can see how the candidate would, whether a challenger or incumbent, would begin to tailor what they say when they're interviewed by these PACs prior to getting their check. These PACs actually interview candidates, and the bulk of the PAC money goes to the incumbents. They don't take their chances very often with challengers.
How, though, are PACs able to get around the laws that put these monetary limits on campaign contributions?
Well, there are two different groups, for example, that give a substantial amount of money at one time, the unions and, for example, the Israeli lobby. And both of these have multiple PACs. And then the word sort of goes out from one of the major PACs that interviews, and all the other PACs follow. You can just trace when a certain contribution comes in from one of the PACs, and then within a week or two, 15, 20, 30, up to 70 or 80 different PACs will contribute to a candidate. They do that, and then they also do something which is called bundling. That is, they ask people on their list to contribute to a candidate, to send the campaign contribution to them, and then they bundle up these contributions and they send the $1,000 contributions or less to the campaigns. But of course, it is very clear who it was that raised this money for them, and so that exceeds the law in the technical sense that a particular PAC might send a candidate 100 $1,000 contributions at a single time.
What's interesting and pointed out in Phil Stern's new book, Still the Best Money, the Best Congress Money Can Buy, is the investment return for these PACs and these financial contributions. AT&T put about $1.5 million in congressional campaigns between 1979 and 1986 and got a $12 billion set of tax benefits in return. And he points out that General Electric and other companies are really witnesses to what Will Rogers said when he described Congress back in the 1930s as the best money can buy. So you have the oil PACs and the textile PACs and the doctor PACs and the auto dealer PACs and even the chicken coop manufacturer PACs, all zeroing in on key members of key committees from which they want certain goodies, whether it's an investment credit or suppression of a particular bill that they find unfriendly to them, or passage of a bill, or a particular corporate subsidy that's part of the corporate welfare programs that proliferate in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so the unions do precisely the same thing.
They don't seem to be getting as much, though.
they have maintained their position basically through a hostile administration, an administration that wanted to curb their power but was unable to do so because of the influence that they have, for example, with the various labor committees in both the House and Senate, where the members of those committees are wholly owned subsidiaries of the unions.
But is there a cause and effect? And can you prove that because a PAC gave certain money to a particular congressperson, that that congressperson then changed their mind and voted in support of the PAC?
Not only cause and effect, but many members admit it. In a series of interviews pointed out in Phil Stern's book, one-fifth of them actually admitted it openly. And as you know, this is not something which is usually admitted. One good example is the Federal Trade Commission was going to issue a rule based on a decency towards one neighbor, which would have required used car dealers to tell prospective purchasers about known defects in the car they were about to buy. It didn't require the used car dealer to inspect or do anything like that, just if they knew. And the car dealers associations opposed this, poured money into Congress, and got a bill overruling the Federal Trade Commission. So this happens all the time, whether it's blocking legislation or overruling agency decisions or getting, and most likely it's getting these tax benefits, getting these subsidy programs through Congress, or getting legitimizing of certain government contracts that are being steered toward certain corporations.
We had a famous instance a few years ago of an amendment which passed the Congress by a 2-to-1 margin, which was actually a sort of nationalist anti-foreign aid amendment, but it would have affected the banks. And the banks got to work, and within 48 hours, they reversed that vote and got a 2-to-1 in the other direction. And if you look at who switched, there is no question but what these banks weighed in with those people that they had supported.
Also, these contributions are keyed to the committees that the legislation comes out of. For example, it's no coincidence that the bank PACs focus heavily on the House Banking Committee and the Senate Banking Committee in terms of who they give their money to.
Well, as a matter of fact, members fight over committee designations because they say, well, if we get on this PAC, on this committee, it is so much easier to raise money from PACs as opposed to, say, the Foreign Relations Committee, where it is much more difficult to raise money because the PACs don't care about it. But if you're on the Commerce Committee or if you're on the Banking Committee or you're on the Appropriations Committee, oh, boy, that is considered lucrative. And so the Committee on Committees that works these things actually get pressure from members based on what kind of money they can raise for their campaigns rather than looking at the good of the country and what kind of public service they can do by being members of these committees.
How, though, do PACs target particular members of Congress?
Well, I don't think it's very difficult. They watch who gets on the committees, and in some cases, they even assist people getting on the committees. And once these people are on the committees, where the committees relate to their business, they go after these people, and they put enormous pressure on them. And the way the members have to begin raising money the minute they get elected, if a particular set of PACs makes it easier for the member to raise money and to get money in the Treasury, they will manage to I think have quite an impact because the member is very grateful. Most members don't like to have to raise money, and so the members are very grateful to those PACs which say, look, we'll host a fundraiser for you. And then they get all of their employees and they get other people in the associations and so on to come to these fundraisers. And the guy may walk away with $100,000 in one crack just by going to a reception for an hour and a half. And, you know, when the person who put this together comes calling on the member of Congress, I can assure you, as somebody who worked for two members of the Senate leadership, that they get in.
And you know what else is important is to describe the intensity of the flow of the funds. There are some senators who raise $10,000 to $20,000 a week, 50 weeks a year, for 6 years to get their campaign kitty up to the $6, $7 million level. And there are members of Congress that have to, of the House, who raise $5,000 a week or something on that order. So there are constant absorption of time by the members of Congress, always on the phone, always having lunch, always currying the favor of people who can give them money or cause money to be given to them. Meanwhile, average citizen groups, people who just want to discuss substantive issues, want to discuss the great questions and the small questions of a political democracy, can hardly get into the door to see a senator or representative. They're lucky if they see a senatorial or representative aide because they haven't paid the ticket of admission.
But what is wrong with an organization, whether it's a PAC or not, but let's call it a PAC, supporting a candidate who believes what they do? Let's say the NRA is supporting a particular candidate that believes in the values of the NRA. Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, yes, because it puts money as the supreme determiner or shaper of what legislators do instead of their beliefs and the beliefs of their constituents. It also puts to a great disadvantage the millions of Americans who only have their vote to influence their member of Congress. And I've always believed that your vote should be nullified only by someone who's voting against you, not by someone who can write a $5,000 check to an incumbent or challenger.
Well, there I would have some disagreement with Ralph. I don't have a problem with the so-called issue-oriented or ideological PACs, which actually stand for something on both ends of the political spectrum, because I think that is part of the American political process. And in that sense, the PACs can act as mutual funds for people out there who wouldn't know which candidates to support because of their position on issues. What I have a big problem with are all the vast majority of the political action committees who stand for nothing other than their particular special interest and who then, will give to any candidate will agree to in effect, be responsive to them, and particularly incumbents who will work on these incumbents until they get what they want. And the rest of the incumbents' voting record can cancel out that position as long as they're responsive to that particular group.
I'm speaking with consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative Paul Weyrich, who have joined forces to argue for congressional election finance reform. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Ralph Nader and Paul Weyrich about the corrupting influence of campaign financing for congressional candidates. Do the two main parties, the Democratic and Republican parties, are they interested in controlling or limiting the control of PACs?
Well, no. I think both parties have encouraged the development of PACs. And as a matter of fact, they sort of threaten PACs now if they don't give to their candidates that they're going to pass legislation. So the game now has been to come in and say, well, you know, we've been supporters of PACs, but if you don't give to our candidates in this election cycle, we'll do you in. And so then the PACs begin to reshuffle who it is they contribute to. So both political parties have played this game. And as a matter of fact, you'll notice that PAC legislation alternately passes the Senate and the House, but never both. And the reason is because it's a sort of game that is played between the leadership of the Congress not to pass legislation, but to make sure that they can get a vote in one House or another so that the senator or congressman can go back and say, oh, yes, when the issue came up, I voted right. But in point of fact, the legislation never manages to pass.
Except this year, a campaign finance bill did pass that limited how much members could receive from PACs, but it was vetoed by President Bush.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that it favored incumbents, which is the usual argument that all incumbents who don't want campaign finance reform give, because it makes them look good. But There are so many different versions of reform on Capitol Hill, but the momentum is toward reform compared to a few years ago. The question is, what kind of reform, how far does it go?
And yet incumbent is a dirty word in this election, and it looks as if you can believe the pollsters and whoever, that there are going to be a lot of new people in Congress. These are outsiders. Do you think they're going to championing this cause, or do you think once they get on the inside, they're going to want the same deal that incumbents have had?
If we can get some kind of action in the first 6 months of the new Congress, there is an opportunity to do something. If it goes beyond that, the same forces will begin to take control as they have with so many of these other people, because it's the path of least resistance. The reason that incumbents, by the way, are having a problem this time isn't because of this. It is because of the bank scandals and the restaurant scandal and the post office scandal and all of these things, which
were the pay grab
and the perks and so on, which were brought to the public's attention, in some cases by us, by the way, in opposition to both political parties. And so the public is fed up, but this has not become an issue.
And yet, certainly Watergate brought in financial reform in presidential campaigns. Why, for instance, didn't something like the SNL crisis do the same thing for Congress?
Well, that's a very good question. And people who do want reform of these campaign finance scandals are saying that the least that could occur is to have the same process that applies to post-primary presidential candidates, say between Bush and Clinton, where they're given a choice. They either can take private money or not take money from the checkoff on the 1040 tax return, or if they take money from the public, they can't take private money. And one recommendation is, well, why don't you apply that to congressional races, at least for a start?
And is that something that you would support, Ralph Nader?
Yes, it certainly is a start. I mean, either the citizens are going to fund our political campaigns, or the auto, oil, medical lobby, and all the other lobbies are going to do so, the banks, the insurance companies. That's our choice. And it's really the best investment citizens can make, especially if it's on a well-promoted voluntary checkoff on the 1040 return, because the total every 2 year tab for congressional elections is less than $500 million every 2 years, which is about half the price of one B-2 bomber. And if we can fund these campaigns, then the telephone companies and the electric companies and the oil companies won't be investing $1 million, $2 million in Congress and getting billions of dollars of subsidies and tax benefits and other goodies in return.
Paul Ryrick, would you agree with that? And it sounds like what you're saying, Ralph Nader, is that you would be for complete public financing of congressional campaigns.
Well, you can't do that under the Supreme Court. What you can do is give the candidates a choice. If they choose to take the public financing, they can't take private money. And if they don't, if they do take private money, then they're not going to get any public financing.
Yeah, as long as that option is kept open, I think it ought to be looked at. I don't think we ever want to exclude somebody from coming in the way that Perot has, whether you support him or don't support him. I fear a system where people are locked out and locked into a system where nobody can get around it. So as long as people are given that option, where if incumbents just get entrenched, that somebody in fact can come around and spend their own money or raise private money to do it, I think that ought to be looked at. I also think, though, that we have to link it with reform of the perks that they get, because otherwise you will have a situation where if somebody takes money, it'll be limited, because the corollary to taking money is that there's a cap on what federal money is spent. And if the perks are not curbed, then the incumbents are really going to have a great advantage, because nobody will be able to raise enough money to overcome the $2 million a year that they spend on, in effect, their own reelection once they get in.
Referring to, they have their own TV studios and radio studios in Congress. They use the franking privilege to send millions of letters out, and too many of them use existing staff around election time to go out and help reelect themselves.
These guys have mobile units with their names printed in big letters. They got enough staff to the point where out in the district, some of these members of Congress have more franchise offices than McDonald's, in their district. I mean, you can run into one in your neighborhood.
I don't know if this is a fair characterization, but I see you, Ralph Nader, and you, Paul Weyrich, as opposite ends of the political spectrum. Do you find yourselves surprised to be in agreement on this issue?
Yes and no. We are in more and more agreement on more and more of these institutional questions because politics is becoming less liberal versus conservative and more establishment versus anti-establishment. And neither one of us represents the establishment. And both of us coming from our opposite ends of the political spectrum, I think, see the same appalling things. We may occasionally have different remedies. But I think that we have observed the same things in the political life of this country.
Ralph Nader?
I'd agree with that.
Well, Jerry Falwell actually called you, Paul Weyrich, the Ralph Nader of our cause. This was about 10 years ago. What do you think about that?
Well, I was complimented because one thing about Ralph is that, A, he is a serious person, and, B, he's not a fraud. That is to say, he lives the views that he expresses. And in that sense, I don't mind being compared to him. Quite the contrary, I'm honored. Because he is, whatever you say about him, and we certainly disagree on a variety of issues, but he's not a phony. And this city is so laden with phonies that, frankly, he's a breath of fresh air from time to time.
Paul Weyrich, how do you think George Bush has done in this campaign as a leader of the Republican Party?
Well, I don't think very well because he has failed to lay out a vision of where he wants to take the country. And I think that's one of the reasons he's in political trouble, because those people who are interested in the future, and elections by and large are about the future, have not been attracted to him the way they were to Ronald Reagan, because they haven't heard anything, and they know in many cases the country is in trouble, and he really doesn't acknowledge that. In fact, he suggests that those of us that say things are in decline are wrong. Well, I'm afraid that people understand inherently that things are in decline, and they're looking for the candidate that addresses that.
And Ralph Nader, what is your take on the Democratic Party's move to the middle, move to a more conservative agenda?
Well, it's hard to differentiate now, increasingly, Republicans and Democrats. George Bush made a very interesting statement a few weeks ago, and he said, Bill Clinton sounds too much like me. I think that's a very telling commentary on the increasing convergence of the Democratic and Republican parties to favor the interests whose strings are being pulled by this big money that we've been discussing. I think the first and fundamental measure of any politician running for office in this country is the degree to which he or she is going to emphasize strengthening the tools of democracy for millions of Americans in their respective roles as voters, taxpayers, workers, consumers, and shareholders. That's where the real change will come from, as it has in our history, bottom up.
Consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative political strategist Paul Weyrich are working together to advocate for the financial reform of congressional campaigns. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane.